It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
Let's Talk Legal with Harvell & Collins, attorneys in law, the right advice at the right time. And Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins are with us once again. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Ben.
What are we talking about today, Cecil?
Ben, I think that a week or so ago, Wes began to talk about homeowners associations.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to continue to discuss kind of the different aspects of our clients and our listeners who happen to own property that is part of a homeowners association. You know, it really is the general rule now.
Right.
Most folks mm-hmm. are in a homeowners association. It might just be, you know, a street organization that maintains the street, very simple. Or of course it can be a much more, developed homeowners association, like for instance, a condominium, mm-hmm. townhome community, PUD, PUD, something of that, PUD, planned urban development, some of that nature, which have very formalized, agreements. But, you know, as we've said many times on the program, this is real.
Mm-hmm.
We take title to our property, and we take title to our property subject to these, restrictions, if you will, covenants, agreements, decisions of homeowners associations. We are in a democracy
mm-hmm.
at that point as to our ownership of our property. And of course, as a result of this, nothing hits home closer than, you know, our property,
right.
our home place. As a result of this, there are, you know, conflicts. There are questions. You really cannot be a lawyer and not get questions relative to homeowners associations. So any of you callers who are listening, if you have a question, give us a call. And Wes will just kind of take it from there.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't even think about it. They think about it more as a social group, but it's really quasi-governmental group, right?
No question about it, Ben. And, you know, we talked a couple of weeks ago. We've you know, gone over this topic before on the program. But we talked a couple of weeks ago about the, you know, the documents, because we always say when we get the callers on these questions, mm-hmm. you know, we have to go back to the documents and see what they say. And normally what we're talking about with regard to the documents when we get these questions about covenants and restrictions of what you can and cannot do on your property or mm-hmm. limitations on the common area or any of these type things, then the document, really the primary document we're talking about is the covenants, or the declarations. And that's the document that the developer puts on record. It's recorded in the respective register of deeds. And it is going to indicate what all those restrictions are on the property. So mm-hmm. for folks out there interested in buying property, you know, take a look at those covenants pretty closely before you buy, because
right.
you'll be subject to those. So, you know, going back to, you know, what we touched on a couple of weeks ago, the other documents we see is obviously the association is a nonprofit corporation. So you're going to have bylaws.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have articles of incorporation. So, but the primary documents we look at are going to be those covenants and the bylaws, but the bylaws really don't restrict the use of real property. They're more along the lines of how the corporation operates, like who the officers are,
mm-hmm.
you know, what their name, you know, president, vice president, treasurer, secretary, that type thing. Notice what we have to do, in order to, you know, have a meeting, what the quorum requirement is, meaning how much participation do we have to pass things,
right?
Those type things. So in many cases, though, however, our covenants just aren't really what the developer thought he needed or she needed at the time that the association got started or the development got started. And then those covenants need to be amended.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting, you know, situation, because, you know, the question would be, you know, how do we amend those? Do we look at the bylaws and do we just need a quorum to amend, or what do we need?
Mm-hmm.
Well, basically, you have to look at the covenants themselves
mm-hmm.
to determine what the amendment requirement is.
Oh, so that is listed in those covenants.
In a well-written set of covenants. Not every set of covenants I've ever seen, but yes, in a well-written set of covenants, you will have a provision that indicates how much property owner involvement or owner involvement you have to have in mm-hmm. order to amend. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, also you have to go through all the formality that's required in the bylaws for a proper meeting as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't just, you know, write everyone a letter and say, send me a piece of paper and tell me what you want.
Right.
No, you have to give notice. You have to go through this, you know, due process, type procedure where everyone can come forward and voice their opinion and so on and so forth. You know, if they wish, go through the process of, you know, gathering proxies, go through the process of gathering proper absentee ballots, mm-hmm. all of these type things. But really, when we're talking about amendment, the amendment is going to have to be consistent with the percentage that we see in the actual covenants. Normally, I would say probably the most common number we see, 75%.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we see that 67%. Sometimes we see covenants that are devoid of any language regarding amendment. We're at 100% then, you know, as
right.
far as having to amend those covenants. So, you know, associations sometimes get themselves twisted a little bit with that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very important that those rules are followed specifically, because in the event they're not, then what happens? Well, you have a property owner, a group of property owners that are not happy with what happened.
Mm-hmm.
They would not have voted for it. The procedure didn't get followed.
Right.
And then they end up taking some legal action and attacking what was done. And if it wasn't done right, then it's not going to be upheld. And, you know, we could be in court dealing with that.
You mentioned at the very beginning that there sometimes a developer will build a property and then they want to decide, or maybe the owners, have they bought into it as it's built out? They decide they want to change some of those things. Are there
right.
are there transitional statements in covenant language to take you from the developer to the homeowners?
Yeah, the way that's normally handled is that the developer is typically interested in having as much control as possible until they get to a tipping point where the developer feels as though that there will be enough other third-party owners to govern themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So if the developer owns all the lots, well, that tipping point typically would be when we hit 50% or 51%.
Right.
Then he's 49% or she's 49%, and then we lose our voting control. But what we normally see is that we see some type of provision in the covenants that actually gives a developer two votes to the typical owner or regular owners, one vote, until we get to a certain number.
Until you get there, right.
So we are stronger on our votes in order to push through things like amendments to covenants and these type things that might be needed, where the developer can kind of, you know, just do it a whole lot more simpler
right.
than would be done if we have to involve all the property owners.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we normally see that
type
of
risk.
Pullback.
They've got the risk involved.
Well, they've got the money in it.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, developing subdivisions with roads and stormwater management plans and mm-hmm. site plans and
septic and sewer issues.
All that,
oh, yeah,
is, you know, and buying the property and so mm-hmm. on and so forth. This, obviously, as we all know, is not inexpensive.
Mm-hmm. The duty of the maintenance until such time as, you know, enough lots are sold so
mm-hmm.
as to be able to pass that expense along for a long time. The developer, you know, has the duty to maintain the property, do the mowing even,
mm-hmm.
you know, basic kinds of things have got to be, have got to continue to happen until such time as there are, as Wes is kind of describing, more lot owners than there are still lots to be sold.
So, and once it's at that point, and there are plenty of neighborhoods around, as you said, Cecil, that are at that point where people live in homeowners association,
mm-hmm.
it's as important as we got from our caller a couple of weeks ago that they act like one, right?
Well, that's right. And, you know, it seems like every time we go over this topic, we get the call that, you know, I live in an association, I know there's covenants, but they're not active. You know, how does that work?
Mm-hmm.
And typically the way the courts have seen that in North Carolina is that, you know, any property owner who owns property in the subdivision subject to those covenants has the right to enforce those covenants, even if your association is not active.
Mm-hmm.
So, It's not necessarily true that the average property owner is going to want to take that upon themselves, and they can't get, you know, be the,
right,
you know, the police here with regard to everyone's yards and mailboxes and color of their house, that kind of thing. But, you know, if there's a particular situation where, you know, let's say the neighbor is grossly breaching the covenants in some way that is affecting, you know, our, my property value, then I could, or my property use, then I could, use the covenants to enforce that. I could basically, you know, send them the demand letter. Here's the covenants. Here's what you're in breach of. And if you don't respond to this and correct it because we talked about it and tried to work it out and you haven't worked it out, then I'm going to have to go this other route, you know, and hopefully it gets worked out.
Even if the homeowners association does not act, or if they kind of turn a blind eye to it, it can still is. If it's in the covenants, it can be enforced, right?
That is a we get that all the time. Mm-hmm. We end up in situations where the politics of a homeowners association creates problems.
The president of the board told me it was okay.
That kind of thing, or we've got a certain group of owners that are friends of the board, and maybe a certain group of owners who are not friends of the board, and the kind of favors they get done and that type of thing. Well, if it's in the covenants that this has to be this way, whatever it might be, and the board just refuses to enforce it, then the property owner has the right to make a demand on the board to enforce whatever the issue is. And in the event they don't, then this minority property owner, and when I say minority, I mean minority
maybe
group,
on their own, right?
Maybe they're 15%, 20%, right, whatever. Then they have the right to petition the court for derivative relief, meaning my board, as this corporation, will not act to enforce this black and white issue in our covenants. Now I'm going to do it under the derivative claim statute, and we'll talk more about that after the break.
Yep, and that's when the fireworks begin. And we have more to come in a moment here on Coastal Daybreak on the Talk Station. Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law. Of course, you can find them online at harvellandcollins.com. Hey, welcome back here. Coastal Daybreak here on the Talk Station. Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. I want to thank the caller for some positive feedback about Harvell and Collins as well, too. They said they dealt with y'all for a couple of years, and so been very happy with the service there.
Good.
Now, we talk about homeowners associations, which always it seems to end up a feather ruffled us somewhere, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, we were touching on that, you know, derivative claim. I mean, my goodness, this gets to be complicated, and it's too early to make things too complicated. We try to keep this stuff pretty basic, but still, you know, if you have a situation where the board is just not going to enforce, you know, covenants, and it is something that is important to you and you feel as though it needs to be enforced, or you have a group of people who don't, you know, maybe they're the minority, therefore, when I say the minority, they're 20, 30, 40%, therefore they don't have the voting power to vote the board out, that type of thing, but their interests are not being protected because the covenants clearly say, for example, you know, you can't have an RV in your driveway, you know, and the president's best friend keeps his RV in the driveway all year. That kind of thing. And it's right next door to me. And by the way, the president lives half a mile away on the other side of the subdivision. So he doesn't have to look at it. And then the mother-in-law comes and lives in it for 6 months out of the year. I mean, we hear all kinds of stories. But anyway.
That's right.
If there's just a failure to, you know, to uphold those covenants and enforce those, then we do have that right under the statutes. It's 55A-7-40. That is the derivative claim statute that allows for the smaller group or minority group of shareholders or owners in a subdivision to then ask the court, look, the covenants say this, please enforce this. And if you don't do it, then within 90 days is a typical period of time. You have to give them a pretty long period of time to fix it.
Right.
Then we're going to bring this action in court. And by the way, in the event that we prevail, the statute allows us to recover our attorney's fees for having to go through this trouble and this expense.
Mm-hmm.
So, General Assembly, you know, through our statutes does recognize that we sometimes end up in this situation with homeowners associations or any type of corporation because we have that type of derivative claim statute really under business corporations, LLCs, nonprofits. It's available,
sure,
that type of relief. So that's something that we end up sometimes having to do. We have, I think, one or two of those type cases proceeding forward right now, you know, actually.
Yeah, so. as you said, you know, as Cecil, as you began, this is a democracy. This is kind of the appeal process. I mean, this is the way that somebody may believe that a governing body is not acting correctly. they can act.
That's correct.
I think, Ben, that this area, you know, of homeowners association touches, you know, so many different substantive areas of the law.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, real property law, corporate law, you know, contract law. I mean, it's a very diverse body of law that many times we have to kind of decipher in order to weed out the stuff that doesn't matter and get to the bottom line here. I mean, we get questions about board of directors liability.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
sure,
there is liability,
yeah,
as a board member or an officer of this corporation.
Anybody that handles money, there's a liability.
There is corporate law involved in terms of the fact that this is a corporation. It's got to up and walk and talk like a corporation, as we've discussed before. It's got to be managed in a corporate format, with officers, with boards, you know, with the right kind of authority to act. We have situations where one homeowner, you know, rides around his golf cart and acts like he owns the whole doggone place, you know,
right,
and he happens to be the president, let's say, and he's out there or she's out there, you know, making all these decisions about things without the appropriate kind of underlying authority.
Mm-hmm.
This is a problem. So these cases come to us in every shape and size, so you know, it's just kind of good to kind of lay
right
out some of the it's good to know that there are usually are answers to these questions,
right,
in one of those areas of the law.
You know, we talk about it in our lives that we should, you know, our advice from you guys often is that we need to review our wills, review our basic documents. Are these things, are bylaws and covenants even, are things that need to be periodically reviewed?
Absolutely. You know, over the years, we have certainly met with homeowners associations for the purposes of just revamping their documents.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, a good board, a good president, you know, is going to recognize that there's liability that potentially will cost the association in the event they don't stay up to speed.
Right.
And you know, the question would be for the typical listener, you know, these were set up by a lawyer to start with. Why do they need to be reviewed? Well, the reason why is because the cases in North Carolina, there's tons of homeowners association cases.
Right.
And the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, they make decisions that affect how these things work, how these bylaws work, and how these covenants work. And sometimes they become over time antiquated because of just the precedent changing over time.
Sure.
So it is a good idea. You know, I would say probably every 5 to 8 years,
mm-hmm,
you know, to have an attorney who really practices in this area, who knows the law and knows the cases and can send you in the right direction to make sure that you don't have any problems. And the
mm-hmm
advice could be, well, I've done my, you know, 1 hour review. Everything looks good. I don't think we need to change anything.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So it just depends on the circumstances. But yes, it's a good idea to have those documents reviewed and updated if necessary.
We'll have more to come in a moment here on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law. They're available for you too. You can call them for an appointment at 726-9050, and more in just a moment. And welcome back for our final segment here with Harvell and Collins, Attorneys at Law, and Let's Talk Legal. We want to talk a little bit about, well, you know, when you enforce that, that usually means there may be a fine somewhere along the line.
Yeah, we get to the Planned Community Act. Mm-hmm. You know, we've talked about the Nonprofit Corporation Act and the fact that homeowners associations are nonprofit corporations. We talked about the bylaws this morning, and we mm-hmm. talked about the covenants this morning, restrictions, declarations. All the same thing, covenants, restrictions, declarations, you know, and then, you know, we have to superimpose on top of all of that, North Carolina General Statute 47F, act regarding homeowners mm-hmm. associations. And it's a governing statute, that deals with homeowners association and really serves as a stopgap mm-hmm. with regard to areas where these other governing documents don't operate.
Right.
Now, one of the areas that we deal with regard to that is under 47F-3-107.1, which is really a list of things that the association can do with regard to taking away rights, with regard to fining people for mm-hmm. violations. And, you know, we deal with this, you know, quite often really on both sides, because the association on some, you know, in some particular situation say, well, okay, so-and-so went and built a fence on their property.
Mm-hmm.
There's a specific provision that indicates that you can't build a fence unless you get architectural control, approval. And now what do? We want to go take the fence down because we've got several neighbors who are upset about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we would not have approved it. Well, I think first question would be, would you have approved it? Because if you had, let's be reasonable here.
Yeah.
You know,
go back,
let's give them an opportunity to submit it and do everything. But in the event it's something that would not be approved, I mean, a 10-foot high fence or something that mm-hmm. just doesn't fit in the association, in the subdivision, then under the Planned Community Act, then, you know, you have a right to give notice, tell them what the violation is, let them know there's going to be a hearing. You can come forward and put on your evidence as to why you think that, you are in conformance. And in the event that you don't, then we're going to have to make a determination as to the fine mm-hmm. that we will impose against you. So then after that hearing, if you come forward and put on your evidence, so on and so forth, then the association does have the right under the Planned Community Act, this is 47F, to fine the violator
mm-hmm.
after 5 days, 5 days after the determination of the violation, to fine the violator up to $100 per day.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that will continue to accrue until the violation is cured.
All right.
So that is the method for basically, yep. enforcing the covenants.
So there's teeth yep. to these covenants.
There's $100 a day adds yeah, up pretty
you
quickly.
Bet, you sure bet. Right. Full set of dentures. More to come in just a moment.